Moncrief on News Talk.
Now, for two decades, many refugee children in Sweden have been suffering from a puzzling syndrome. They can fall into a sort of swoon, which can last for months or even years. Most gradually recover, yet it's far from clear what causes it. This and other puzzling cases feature in urologist Suzanne O'Sullivan's new book called The Sleeping Beauties and Other Stories of Mystery Illness. And Suzanne joins us now on News Talk. Good afternoon, Suzanne.
Good afternoon.
These children are they located in one particular part of Sweden or in various locations in Sweden?
Well, they are in various locations, but they are clustered more in the southern area of Sweden. This condition occurs almost exclusively in Sweden. It's occurred in a couple of other countries, but it is mostly in Sweden among a small number of ethnicities.
Right. Is there an age profile it happens to?
Yeah, it has affected people between the age of 7 and 19. But, you know, the children that I met who were affected by this condition were only 10 and 11 years old, and that's quite common.
Right, okay. But it's not a coma. Is it like, are all their kind of, if you like, vital signs saying this person should be awake?
You know, it's hard to know what to call it, to be honest, because it's so unprecedented. Essentially, they don't respond at all. They're like little rag dolls, these children. They don't open their eyes or move if you try to lift them. They don't eat, they don't talk. But if you then test their brains by parameters to see if they're awake or asleep, they appear to be awake, but unable to interact with the world. So it's kind of hard to know what to call it. And in Sweden, it has essentially been called apathy, which has changed into the name resignation syndrome.
And when they fall into this state, does it happen gradually?
Yes, it's a very slow thing. So the important point, obviously, is that all of these children are seeking asylum in Sweden. They're all facing deportation. And in the face of that stress, they begin to just very gradually withdraw. And then they slowly enter this state. And then some have stayed in it for several years.
And when they come out of it, is it just as gradual?
Yes, they recover at a similar rate as one would expect if someone had been bedbound for a long period of time. I met a young girl who was 10 years old when I met her, and she'd been in it for a year and a half. That was 2 years ago. She's coming out of it now to the point that she can walk around, but she can't speak.
Still, my word. Those who recover and can speak, do they have a memory of it? And what do they describe it as being like?
Yeah, they're very reluctant to talk about it, actually, which is kind of, you know, kind of a little bit chilling because it makes one think it must be quite traumatic. One boy described it like being trapped in a glass box at the bottom of the ocean, and you have the feeling that the water is pressing in on you, which is a terrifying description. Although another girl said it was like being in a dream that you just couldn't wake up from.
And were they aware of things going on around them?
The children seem to be very slightly aware of things going around them, things happening around them, but they don't have a normal level of awareness.
Now, and presumably many of these children have been tested. In terms of their brain activity, what does that tell you?
Yeah, they've been extensively tested, and their brain imaging and blood tests and any manner of test really is normal, which suggests that this has a psychological mechanism. So there's lots of sort of cognitive mechanisms that we use to kind of protect ourselves against difficult memories or things we don't want to think about. So they're shutting down one of these cognitive mechanisms to protect themselves against what they're facing.
Yeah. Now, is it clear that there is some sort of a relationship between the state and the asylum process or the asylum application process?
Yeah, there does seem to be a very clear relationship there, and it's consistent in all of the children. The asylum process, I mean, Sweden's very welcoming to immigrants, you know, much better place for an asylum seeker to end up than many countries. But the process is very slow. They have to apply for asylum 3 times. They can be rejected 3 times. That could take several years. And these children gradually withdraw as they progress through this process.
It's a very and the youngest age, though, you know, at the younger age range of this, would they still be aware of all that going on?
Well, you know, the children, it's impossible to protect them. And another thing really is that often the children, because they arrive in Sweden at a very young age, they learn the language and their parents don't learn the language as easily. And often the children are sort of the conduits for information between authority figures and their parents. So, you know, people try to protect them, but it's impossible to shield them from what's happening.
Has there anything similar to this or analogous to this ever happened to any other people anywhere else?
Well, this actual syndrome is beginning to appear in other places in the world. So it's now, there's been a small number of cases in Nauru, which is an island that deals with immigrants off the coast of Australia. And there's also been some in Greece. But also, this isn't terribly dissimilar to some things that happen to, you know, my patients. I'm a neurologist and I see people who lose consciousness through similar sort of mechanisms all the time. So it's not terribly unusual for someone to lose consciousness in a traumatic situation. What is unusual is for it to last this long.
And I suppose, as far as can be tell, long term, when the kids wake up from this, are there any signs of lasting damage?
Yeah, I mean, you know, anecdotal reports say that these children can make good recoveries. And I certainly heard of children who'd sort of gone through the schooling system, gone to university, although it's very hard for me to believe there would be no aftermath. You know, if a child, you know, when you're 7 years old, that's when you're supposed to be learning social interactions. And that's when your brain is maturing. It would be very hard to think there would be no sequelae from being unconscious for a couple of years in those vital years.
Yeah, it's a puzzler, right? Another very odd one that you write about in the book was what was happening, or what did happen in the US embassy in Cuba.
Yeah.
Where I at the time, there was a lot of speculation, at least, that there was some sort of weapon being used there. Could you describe briefly what happened to the people in the embassy?
Yeah, so after the U.S. embassy opened in Cuba in 2016, it was a sort of a fraught atmosphere, obviously, because of the history between the countries. And at the end of 2016, an American diplomat heard a loud noise and began to develop mild neurological symptoms like dizziness and unsteadiness. Because of the sort of risk of attack within the embassy, that diplomat suspected that he had been attacked by something, and given it was a noise, thought perhaps it was a sonic weapon or a sound weapon, which I have to point out is a completely unprecedented and sort of impossible thing to happen. But the story really became very salient and very vivid within the embassy, and they started advising embassy employees to hide behind walls if they heard vivid noises, for example. And then, of course, several other people started being concerned that they had a similar neurological problem. What I found most interesting is that, you know, all of their tests were normal and the symptoms fit very well with the psychosomatic disorder. But because that diagnosis was presented to the diplomats in such a pejorative way, they preferred to believe in a sonic weapon, which for many, many reasons was entirely impossible.
Right. So would your suspicion be there was some degree of contagion in this, but the contagion was suggestion?
Absolutely. I mean, we're going through a pandemic at the moment, so we know what it's like to be asked to search your body for symptoms. You know, if you're told that there's some terrible disease out there or a sonic weapon and that you might be affected by it and you could die, the first thing you do is examine your body for symptoms. The healthy body is not within the conscious awareness. But the minute you start paying attention to your body, you notice all sorts of things.
Mm.
So it's very easy to develop symptoms in the context of such a stress.
And going back to the refugee children, might something similar be at play there in the sense that it's a highly stressful situation for them, and a child might see another child react to that stress in a certain way and therefore react themselves in the same way?
Yeah, absolutely. But at more of, I agree with what you're saying, but at more of an unconscious level. So the minute you're faced with deportation or any one of us in a stressful situation, our heart rate will increase, our breathing will increase. That's innate. Anyone gets it. But if these children have, if a story has entered their community that says that once you notice these initial stress-like feelings in your body, the next thing that might happen is that you develop apathy, and the next thing might happen is you won't be able to get out of bed, then at an unconscious level, the brain can really become overwhelmed by these predictions so that you play them out unconsciously.
Suzanne, fascinating to speak with you. Thanks very much for doing so. Suzanne O'Sullivan's latest book is called The Sleeping Beauties and Other Stories of Mystery Illness. You are listening to The Moncrief Show on News Talk. We have to take a break. Back in a couple of minutes.
Moncrief on News Talk.